Midlands today with Tullamore Opel Church Road Tullamore. Time to cross over the new Mokka. Test drive your 231 Opel Mokka at Tullamore Motors Church Road Tullamore. See tullamoremotors.ie. When people in the Midlands want to talk, they talk to Will Faulkner.
Well, good morning. How was your bank holiday? Did you go for a swim?
You could probably do it in your back garden after that weather, or your front garden for that matter, or your front room if you live in the wrong area. Coming up today, what else does Mother Nature have in store? The Riddle of Mary Lou. Shane Ross discusses his new book about the Sinn Féin leader, for which he has been threatened with legal action. And, unfortunately, the weekend saw the burial of Lindsay Bennett, a very brave young lady who campaigned to raise awareness of cervical cancer, to expose some of the failings within the state's healthcare. And in memory of her, we want to give you a feature today about cervical screening, about the precautions that should be taken to try and find some good from what has been a terribly hard lesson learned. When you call 0818 300 103 is the Midlands 103 comment line. You can text or you can WhatsApp 083 30 10 103, powered by Lamb Brothers Toyota in Tullamore. Lots of very happy people on the front of the newspapers today because it was Halloween. By God, would you have got soaked if you went trick-or-treating last night? Well, on the front of the Irish Times, you see cousins Arlo Lynch, who was 3, and Jake Glenn, who is also 3, getting ready for Halloween. Also front of the Irish Independent, from Slane in County Meath, Connachie and Brendan McCardle. And there's a fantastic picture on the front of the Irish Examiner as well, of a dragon, well, the skeleton of a dragon, on parade through the streets of Cork City last night. Now, what are the headlines saying? 4 in 10 Gardaí stations see crime rise despite lockdown. This is a special investigation in the Irish Independent. Of course, the other way of phrasing that headline is 6 in 10 Gardaí stations didn't see a crime rise since lockdown, which is a far more positive way of framing it. But anyway, there are many Gardaí stations documented on independent.ie. Your own Gardaí station may well be there. And you can check out how crime has moved in your area over that period. But there are many parts of the Midlands where the rate decreased. Now, some are very small Gardaí stations. Stradbally, 94% reduction in crime. I doubt very much Stradbally has seen a reduction that sharp. It's probably because the opening hours of the Gardaí station are so few and far between, the crime gets reported in Portlaoise instead. Likewise, Delvin in County Westmeath seeing a decline. But again, Delvin, many of the calls will go to Mullingar, presumably. So anyway, that's in the Irish Independent. The Irish Times shows RTE accused the Taoiseach over the licence fee of inaction and undermining the state broadcaster. So RTE gets €200 million a year from the licence fee. It also generates €140 million in commercial income. So that's €340 million of a budget altogether. Now, they have argued for a long time that it is unfit for purpose. They need more money to try and achieve what RTE should be achieving. So Moya Doherty, who is the chairperson of the board of RTE, she asked the Taoiseach in July why the Future of Media Commission report, this was the group brought together to try and recommend how media should be funded into the future, why that report lay unpublished, gathering dust on a minister's desk for nearly a year. And subsequently, anyway, Micheál Martin wrote back saying, I want to assure you that it in no way represents a deliberate undermining of what RTE is here to do. But he did absolutely categorically say the licence fee will not be abolished, RTE will not be funded from central exchequer revenue. Instead, they want to look at the collection mechanism of the licence fee so you can't evade it if you're not inclined to pay it. Anyway, that's on the front of the Irish Times handbags, you might say. What else have we got? On the Irish Examiner, Martin rebukes Green and Fine Gael bad politics. So he's concerned that some of his ministers have been under attack from their colleagues in the coalition, that the Green Party and Fine Gael have been particularly critical of housing, which is a Fianna Fáil ministry, of health, which is another Fianna Fáil ministry, education. You see the pattern here. So we're coming into the period where there will be the flip-flop from Micheál Martin to Leo Varadkar, the office of Taoiseach shall change. And the different parties are looking at options and alternatives and opportunities for themselves. For instance, the Examiner also suggests Fianna Fáil would like the Foreign Affairs brief. It's a nice, handy one. You get to fly all over the world and probably not very controversial. Anyway, outside of the Leinster House bubble, I don't know if too many people will be concerned who gets what job. But that's on the front of the Irish Examiner all the same. I think this story will be of more concern to people. The Irish Independent has done a very worthy exercise. They've looked at a basket of household items, including milk, cheese, bread, those essentials, how much it cost in February in all of the country's big supermarkets, and how much it costs today. And they have found that the basket of shopping in SuperValu is €8.61 more expensive than it was only a few months ago. So that's a 19% increase. A 17% increase in Aldi, a 16% increase in Dunnes Stores. Tesco up only 9%, so that's €3.69 dearer compared to €8.61 in SuperValu. But Lidl fares best of all, an increase of 7% or €2.61. In the basket, bread, milk, butter, pasta, chicken, soft drinks, crisps, cereal, eggs, tea bags, cheese, ham, yogurt, potatoes, bananas, toilet roll and apples. So, are you changing where you shop because of price? This would suggest you certainly should shop around anyway, at the very, very least. Now, as Ireland had a very wet couple of days, if you were in Spain, you would not believe how hot it is. Record temperatures for the time of year, 35 degrees Celsius. In France, temperatures over 9 days were 4 degrees above the average for October. And there were many other examples of this dotted around the continent. And yet there are some who say climate change is not a reality. Well, it certainly is. You know, maybe you debate the causes of it, but there's no denying the amount of rain that has fallen. And the mild autumn that we have had so far is not what would have been the case 30 or 40 years ago. Good news if you're a parent. A double child benefit payment is on the way to you if it hasn't already landed in your bank account. So instead of €140 per child, you will receive €280 per child this month, which is following on from Budget 2023. If you are on the Living Alone allowance, you will receive an extra €200 lump sum this month. And carers can look forward to an extra €500 in the support grant. That's in the third week of November. Also, the fuel allowance payment is due on the third week of this month as well, as well as a €500 extra working family payment. About 44,000 households qualify for that. So November, a big month on the social protection budget. If you are cutting back and if you're concerned with the planet, the Pope should reintroduce not eating meat on a Friday. So say the experts at Cambridge University. They figure this will reduce global carbon emissions. 55,000 tons of carbon per year, whatever the hell that looks like. The obligation to forgo meat on one day a week goes all the way back in canon law, oh, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. It was re-established in England and Wales after a 26-year hiatus, this study says, and they believe it has reduced the carbon footprint in those countries. Well, I don't know if the Pope should necessarily do it. If you decide you want to reduce your intake of meat to try and save the planet, that's your business. Then again, farmers will say, hang on, what about us? Here's a story that will have far more impact on the planet than whether you eat meat or not. In Brazil, there has been a change at the very top. The president, Jair Bolsonaro, has lost the election. And this was quite a right-wing regime where he really didn't give two hoots about the environment, about the Amazon rainforest. He was, and his government was bent on expansion, and the deforestation of the Amazon was something of huge concern to environmentalists the world over, because the Amazon, you could say, is the lung of the planet. And now a left-wing government is due to take over, assuming, of course, Mr. Bolsonaro concedes defeat, which he may not. He's going to make his speech today. And there are many who are disappointed he lost the election. Truckers, for instance, blocked roads in 20 Brazilian states to try and show their solidarity with him. But our president, Michael D. Higgins, wrote yesterday to Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, the new president-elect of Brazil, to extend his congratulations. And it's what's referred to as a pink tide, these leftist electoral triumphs in Latin America, Colombia, Chile, Peru, Argentina, Mexico. They've all seen an emergence of left-wing administrations, and Brazil joining that list now. That is in the Irish Times, if you want to read more. The word of the year, permacrisis. So this is a crisis which is an extended period of instability and insecurity. Another word which again kind of shows the nature of the times that we're in. Kyiv, as in the city in Ukraine. It has been added to the dictionary as a symbol of solidarity. Warm bank is another term which describes a heated building, a library, a place of worship, somewhere that you can go to heat if you cannot afford to heat your own home. Quiet quitting, the act of doing your basic duties at work and no more. Vibe shift is another term, a significant change in the prevailing atmosphere or culture. Yes, the words of the year we shall explore in more detail later. NASA has found a very interesting asteroid, and they are sending a mission to explore this, the Psyche mission. And this asteroid is about 140 miles wide. And okay, hang on, don't get bored, stay with me. Because this asteroid has the potential to make everybody on Earth a billionaire. A billionaire. Okay, now you're interested. So this asteroid, they reckon, is the exposed core of an early planet. So it is laced with nickel, iron, gold, lots of precious metals. And if you were to put a price on it, 8,000 quadrillion euro. Enough to make everybody on Earth a billionaire. So they're going to send up this mission to find out more about it, how they might harvest these metals, get them back and make us all rich. That bit, funnily enough, isn't in the article. I don't think they've quite figured that out. Two other stories. Being happy could make you recover more quickly from a heart attack. Did I say being happy? Oh, there's one other word there. Being happily married. Yes, the researchers at Yale University looked at nearly 1,600 people who were treated for heart attacks. They had an average age of 47, and they discovered the people who reported severe
relationship stress were 67% more likely to report chest pains than people with mild or no relationship problems. I think that stands to reason. If you're in a relationship that's heading south, there's nothing worse. It is bound to exacerbate any heart problems. That's an obvious one for the researchers. Who got paid for that? Playing video games every day can boost your child's brain power. Teachers have often argued it's the opposite. Parents have certainly feared that a 9 or a 10-year-old spending all day in front of a screen isn't going to have very much interest in school. But actually, if they do it for 3 hours a day, they fare better in tests of memory and thinking speed. So every cloud has a silver lining. There is one more story from the papers that I'll share with you a little later. It's confession time when we do this, okay? Especially if you've had a few too many and you've ended up in a strange place. Brenda says, when the ESB bills came out last week, I noticed a big increase in mine. And yet the only lifeline we're getting back from the government isn't enough to cover the increase in the bills. Also, if you happen to come across a set of car keys in Tullamore, a lady has got in touch and, by golly, Colette, you're quite distressed. I get the vibe. So these are keys for a Hyundai i30. There's also a house key on it. And it was lost possibly around the New Road or indeed near the bridge centre. So somewhere in the heart of Tullamore are these car keys. And, well, if you can pass them back, it will be very much appreciated. Now, still on the agenda today, what else does Mother Nature have in store if you've come across some roads that are impassable? Indeed, if you're living near an area where the water line is creeping towards your house, has the local authority, the county council, responded? And I dare not ask farmers somewhere near the Barrow, indeed the Shannon, how much land is underwater and waterlogged at this moment, because it's been just an incredible couple of weeks to see the water table climb so high. Is there any reprieve in store? Next, though, the riddle of Mary Lou. Shane Ross discusses his new book. Mary Lou MacDonald is the odds-on favourite to be Ireland's next Taoiseach. But how much do you know about her? What makes her tick? Why she joined Sinn Féin? And whether she answers to shadowy figures in Belfast, as critics often suggest and Sinn Féin denies. Well, former Minister Shane Ross served with Miss MacDonald in the Dáil, and he was by her side for many years at the Public Accounts Committee and watched her perform. He has just released his new book, looking at the Sinn Féin leader. Shane, good morning.
Good morning, Will, and thank you so much for having me on this morning.
I want to ask first, and I think this is important for what comes later, why did you want to write a book about Mary Lou?
I think Mary Lou is the most interesting person in Irish politics, north and south. She's probably the most influential because she's got such a powerful base in both sides of the border. She's also someone who is likely to be the next Taoiseach, which makes her very significant indeed, and first Sinn Féin minister in the history of the state, first woman Taoiseach as well. But I suppose more than anything else, about Mary Lou, there's so much we don't know. We know what we see. She's a great orator. She's a great personality. She's very popular. She's very gregarious. And she's the leader of the party. But we don't know an awful lot about her. And that's why this book is called Mary Lou MacDonald, A Republican Riddle. She's often referred to by other commentators as an enigma. So what I wanted to do was not just to portray the public face, which is well known, but who is she? What's behind her? What's her background? Where's she come from? How does she think? And I think she is a mysterious person.
Now, you deal with this right out of the traps in the book. How did you set about securing the consent of different guests, different contributors, people who might be able to inform that picture you want to paint?
Well, it was difficult, Will, because I knew her well, and so I thought I might have some cooperation from her. I didn't expect it to be, I didn't want it to be what they call, an authorised biography. In other words, the Sinn Féin message or the Mary Lou message just straight down the line, then it would almost be an autobiography. I wanted to be objective, independent. So I met her, and And I said, look, I'm going to write a book about you. And she was a bit surprised. And she said, oh, all right. But she wasn't madly enthusiastic. So I asked her, only for the cooperation, really, in introducing her to me to members of her family, you know, because I wanted to get stories about her childhood. Nobody knew much about her childhood except where she lived, really. And she said she'd think about that. And she came back after a week and she said she wasn't going to cooperate with the book. She wasn't going to stand in my way. But she said, I'm not going to cooperate with the book. Off you go. And so what I did was it made it a different, slightly different sort of book because I had to dig and do things which she mightn't have liked, but it wasn't her book, nor was it the Sinn Féin book. It was going to be my book. So I talked to members of her family who were, some were helpful, some wouldn't. And then I tried to talk to members of Sinn Féin. And there was an initial response from Sinn Féin members, the ones I knew, and I knew them all very well, the TDs. And they said yes. And then, of course, one by one, they dropped out. They checked with the press office and they said no, they weren't going to be able to cooperate. So I had to do it in a more clandestine way. But that way I found out much, much more. And the book took a very objective, I think, position as a result of that.
Well, how would you respond to concern that you, until recently, were a politician yourself? Once upon a time, you were a member of Fine Gael, I think until 97. That perhaps you weren't the most objective person to write the book.
Well, I was a member of it again 25 years ago. Is that right? Something like that. I mean, it was a very, very long time ago. I've been in it. I was independent before that and independent since. So, you know, and I wrote a book called In Bed with the Blue Shirts, which members of Fine Gael wouldn't have been happy with. That was the last book. I think it's a fair question. Let me answer it. I suspect that I was in a rather unique situation in that I knew her pretty well, and I have to be honest about this. I liked her. And the initial criticism, the initial reaction was, you're rather in her pocket. You like her too much. You're not going to be objective about it. Then, of course, the reaction afterwards is both. Some people are saying, I'm not going to buy that book because it's too antagonistic, too critical of her. Others are saying, I'm not going to buy that book because it's too positive about it. I don't like that woman. I think it's
a bit like the referee. If you're getting it from both teams, you're probably doing a decent job.
Well, I am so, but I did. I was in an advantageous position in some ways because I did know her, and I did also work with her, and that put me in a very close situation to see what she was like to work with, and that was an insider's objective, insider's view of her. And she was really, really powerful on the Public Accounts Committee. And I sat beside her sometimes and I talked to her, and we were involved in an awful lot of situations together, holding people to account and public servants, and combining together with John McGuinness to do things there, which gave me an insight into her. So I think I was in a good position that way. I knew her. I think that was probably a good position. I certainly wasn't a member of Sinn Féin, and I wasn't well-inclined towards Sinn Féin. But I was in a position of a lot of people in that I liked her, but I didn't really like her politics very much. Now, I think that's, you know, it's almost impossible to be objective about Mary Lou McDonald. People have very, very strong views about her. But I did have personal knowledge of her, which I think may help the book and maybe it helped to tell a lot of stories that you wouldn't have had otherwise.
Well, let's start with her circumstances growing up, because it is often presented in a simplistic way that she was from a middle class background, father a successful builder, they lived in a lovely house, she went to a private school, went to Trinity, yada yada yada, rather affluent. But actually the story is rather different.
Yeah, the story isn't the same as is told in kind of shorthand, partly because she's very, very private about her private life. So there's a story has grown up about her, as you say, like that. The truth of the matter is, yeah, they lived in a big house in South Dublin, in well off South Dublin,
That was split into flats.
They were renting. Mm. You see, I mean, that's the point. They didn't own that because it was rented and it was divided. So that's one thing. Second thing is the story about her father, which is an absolutely fascinating story, tragic in some ways and very amusing in other ways. Her father was a character, I think we call in the book, which is a euphemism for someone who's reasonably kind of wild, who got himself into a lot of escapades, which we talk about in the book, which we don't talk about now because I don't want to tell people what's in it, but he got himself into lots of escapades. He's often described as a kind of a builder. He was even raised to being a chartered surveyor in some descriptions. He's not. He was a kind of building contractor who got into difficulties, not all of his own making by any matter of means. He had a really horrible accident soon after Mary Lou was born, and that affected his life for a long time. And he wasn't able to operate properly after that in his job. And as a result of that, there were difficulties in her home life. She wasn't well off or rich or anything like people think. They had difficulties. But what she did have was she had a very good education. Her mother was a very strong person who was absolutely determined that she and her three siblings all had a really good education, privately educated in the convent, as you said, went to Trinity, which is obviously a luxury and was a very privileged place at the time, then went to Limerick University. So she did it. She did have that, and it stood her in very good stead. But it wasn't the classic, you know. She didn't have the kind of Rathgar affluence, which a lot of people associated with her. It must have been difficult for her and for her siblings. But one of the interesting things about Mary Lou's family and her siblings is they all got good degrees at Trinity College Dublin. So they, whatever their difficulties, and that's gone into in the book in a lot of detail, financial and otherwise, they all got a great education and they all got degrees, and they all did very well afterwards after their university education.
And Mary Lou herself, she had a few jobs here and there, but she didn't have a career as such until she entered politics. Now, one of the conundrums, and people can make up their own mind which story they believe, is why she joined Sinn Féin, having initially been a member of Fianna Fáil. What's your take on that?
Well, yeah, my take is that it was a bit of both. She was in Fianna Fáil in Dublin West, and Brian Lenehan was the sitting TD, and she was obviously a very talented member of Fianna Fáil while she was there. She was very Republican in Fianna Fáil, causing a certain amount of trouble and difficulties for them, but very, very committed in that way. Now, one story is, as you say, that she wasn't going to get the Doyle seat that was on offer because Brian Lennon was going to hold that, and no one was going to dislodge him from that, and there was only one Fianna Fáil seat. So she got fed up and she joined Sinn Féin, and off she went as a career move into Sinn Féin, which offered her a very, very stimulating and rewarding career, and which is what she got. The other is that she was genuinely very Republican, that she was in Fianna Fáil. She told Brian Lenehan, there's lots of stories in the book of what she did in Fianna Fáil. She told Brian Lenehan, this party is not Republican enough for me, I'm off. And she left on principle, and she joined Sinn Féin on principle because she believed that they were the real McCoy and they were the real Republicans, and Fianna Fáil had sold out. You can take your pick. I think I make it fairly clear in the book which way I feel about it. But you know, the fact of the matter is, yes, it was an interesting period for her because she was kind of failing to settle into any particular job for any length of time. But when she found Sinn Féin, she joined, and she got a job there, and she joined for good. So she committed. But it's, whether she was a true believer or whether she was an opportunist, that's a riddle. I think we sorted out, but I don't want to say exactly what my take is on it because I want people to read the book.
But you do note in the book, when she presented to Sinn Féin, she was like manna from heaven. The reaction of Gerry Adams, Martin McGuinness, those seasoned, grizzled veterans of the IRA times, they saw her as very acceptable to the electorate. So she ascended the ranks very quickly.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely right. I mean, she was just what they were looking for. Adams, whatever people think of him, and he was a man who thought forward, and he very obviously identified her as something completely new and completely different, miles away from the armed struggle of the Northern veterans who were dominating the party when she joined. And he identified her as someone who would appeal to a larger electorate, particularly in the south of Ireland. And he was right. That's exactly what she did. And she got a European Parliament seat in 2004, very, very, very early. Yeah, she was identified. She joined around 2000, 2001. And she was identified very, very rapidly as being exactly what they wanted. And she moved through the ranks. She got the European nomination. She stood for them in Europe, and she was elected to Europe in 2004. Having been promoted through the ranks of Sinn Féin, very, very quickly, she was on the Arcola in 2001, 2003. She got a prime position in Sinn Féin as well. And this was all because Adams and McGuinness had identified her as the coming person. Then she got the nomination for Europe. People were pretty staggered by the speed with which she got that. But she actually won in 2003. Then she won the seat in 2004, first ever Sinn Féin seat in Europe. And you know, after that, it wasn't without setbacks. But she was all, you know, she ascended up the ranks very, very rapidly.
But you contend in the book that she was playing to two galleries. There was the very public gallery, the electorate, and the success she achieved there. There was a smaller, but within Sinn Féin, very influential gallery in Northern Ireland. And again, there's a whole chapter in the book around funerals and the optics of how she would position herself. Now, I have to take a quick break, Shane, but one question that is often asked of Mary Lou MacDonald is whom she answers to. So we'll come back and explore that after these. Mary Lou MacDonald, A Republican Riddle, is the new book by former Minister Shane Ross. And Shane, there's a chapter in it called Adams Calls the Shots, which is much denied in Sinn Féin. Why are you sceptical?
Well, I think the evidence is that Adams has always called the shots for the 35 years that he was there. I'm sceptical because if you look at the ascent of Mary Lou through the ranks, the position she held as chairman of the party and as vice president of the party and then as leader of the party, she never actually had to stand. She was always unopposed in taking those positions, and so she was never challenged in that way. And that was because Adams and McGuinness, she was their anointed one, and she rose to the ranks courtesy of them, and they didn't have elections, and other people who put in nominations or had them withdrawn. So I think she certainly called the shots. He certainly called the shots all the time that she was there. And indeed, I think she still talks to him. She did an interview with Hugh O'Connell of the Sunday Independent about 2 years ago when she was asked, did she still talk to Gerry Adams? She said, oh, yeah, absolutely. He's a very wise guy and he's very, very useful. And if you notice when there was a spat between him and Owen O'Brien last year at Christmas, when Adams produced a kind of a Christmas song which was pretty controversial and maybe embarrassing for Sinn Féin, O'Brien said that he should apologise for it, and O'Brien was wrapped across the knuckles pretty rapidly, even though Adams was supposedly out of power. So I think he is still an influence there, and he was always a major influence on Mary Lou, who took positions behind him on very controversial issues like the Maria Cahill case, like the Jean McConville case, like the case of his brother Liam, and she took positions where it didn't seem that she was comfortable, but she took them because she was loyal to Adams, and Adams in the end delivered the leadership for her. So I think there was a kind of pact there.
Worth noting, though, and you have a chapter in there about the Maria Cahill case. He was still leader at that time. These days, he has stepped down officially, and it wouldn't be all that unusual for a successor to consult somebody who had sat in that chair to try and get their advice on issues.
No, that's correct. It wouldn't be. I mean, I'm just pointing out that I think there is a great deal of advice probably flowing from that quarter to her. There's a large constituency in Northern Ireland with which she has made herself very, very, the Sinn Féin constituency, very familiar, and where she's now extremely popular. And that is one of the great achievements of Mary Lou, is that she spent, and you referred to it just before the break there, she spent a lot of time, there's a chapter in the book called Playing the Cemetery Game, where she spent an enormous amount of time, unknown to people, I think, until I read it in the book, in Northern Ireland, going to a large number of commemorations, funerals, carrying an awful lot of coffins, buying in a sense, to the message from Northern Ireland and ingratiating herself with the people up there. And it was successful because I spent a large amount of time during the book actually in Anson'stown and places, hardline Republican areas, talking to people about Mary Lou. And what's up, I was expecting to find them saying, we're not all that happy with this well-off southern woman taking over Sinn Féin. But in fact, almost unanimously, not totally, but almost unanimously, they said, yeah, we're really happy. She's the only one who sticks up for us. So having played the cemetery game, having been in Northern Ireland all the time, having spent a large amount of time with people known as the shadowy figures of the hard men, they approve of her. She's won them over. I think that's a really interesting conclusion in the book, because people said they might be sceptical. I don't think they are. They like her and they trust her.
Shane, unfortunately, time has run out. You are signing copies of the book today. Where and when?
I'll be in Athlone this afternoon. I'll be in Easton's, and it'd be really nice to see anybody who wants to come down and obviously buy the book, but have a chat as well, because this is a fascinating subject, and the book is full of really new material which people won't know about, and I think it'll reveal a lot to people which they would be surprised about, particularly in her childhood years. And there's a lot there which tells us about her background, which has formed the person who is Mary Lou today. And that it's, to me, it was the most fascinating book I've written. I've written 5 books now, but this was the most interesting. And I hope other people enjoy it as much as I did.
Shane Ross, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much indeed, Will.
Still to come today, Athlone's great dilemma. What to call the newest bridge when there's already a new bridge? Following the death of cancer campaigner Lindsay Bennett, we look at cervical screening and some of the warning signs to try and salvage some good out of what has been a terribly tragic and hard-learned lesson. And on a more positive note, Philomena Begley, still going strong in the country music scene and very much looking forward to her next performance in the Midlands later this month. Yes, we're already into November. Where is the year going? Now, it certainly feels like November when you look out the window and see all of that heavy rain falling, and more heavy rain and indeed strong wind expected in the near future. We'll be hearing in a moment from a man in the Athlone area who has seen the Shannon rise and do much damage. But first, what's in store? From Met Éireann, Emer Flood is standing by. Morning, Emer.
Morning, Will.
So what levels of rainfall have we seen over recent days? Because we see many fields, many rivers flooded or at capacity. So there must have been significant downpours.
Yeah, there definitely was up to 3 times normal rainfall that we'd normally expect this time of year. So generally over the past week across Leash, Offaly and West Meath, 40 to 60 millimetres of rain fell, much of that in the past couple of days. And even as high as 19 millimetres was recorded in areas of high ground and mountainous regions. So as a result of that, as we have seen, the rivers have risen over the past week, and they will continue to rise over the next few days. A lot of the rivers are already at bank full, and some of them are already above bank full. So that is why there has been flooding, particularly yesterday during Halloween when we saw the persistent rainfall. So in terms of the next couple of days, if any heavy rainfall really was just going to run straight off into the roads and the rivers, as the soils, as we know, are saturated or waterlogged. So any heavy falls of rain will lead to localised flooding. Today, this afternoon, is going to be quite heavy showers. It could be prolonged at times. So again, conditions on the roads won't be great this afternoon. But it's really the conditions tomorrow, Wednesday, up that we're expecting to see localised flooding. It's going to be coming very windy all throughout the day tomorrow, Wednesday. But there will be a spell of heavy, possibly thundery rainfall for a time, kind of during the late morning and early afternoon. So this heavy rainfall, we are expecting to see localised flooding. In particular, it's the kind of smaller tributaries of the Shannon, which are rising at the moment, and as well, as I said, surface water flooding on roads.
And in which parts of the country is the rain likely to be heaviest over the next 24, 48 hours?
It's actually going to be the west, because it's coming in from the Atlantic, where the rain will be heaviest tomorrow. So a bit of an escape for the Midlands, but it will still be quite heavy as the rain crosses the country eastwards over the Midlands. So generally expecting there's still a threat of localised flooding anywhere in the country. As across the country, the soils are saturated. And as I've said, in Westmeath in particular, the rivers are very high at the moment.
Now, how long is this prolonged rain likely to continue for?
The rain is going to come in tomorrow morning, but it will be followed by showers during the afternoon. There's no real great dry spell on the horizon that will allow the rivers to improve and conditions to improve. Even on Thursday, we're going to see some heavy showers again. So further, you know, poor conditions of road, a lot of surface waters on roads, that could occur again on Thursday. The only good news I have for you is that Friday is actually looking not too bad. Friday is looking like it'll be mostly dry, so that will give a bit of a break from the rainfall that we've seen. And as I said, we've had nearly up to three times the normal amount that we typically see for this time of year.
Eimear, grateful for your time. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Will.
Eimear Flood is a meteorologist with Met Éireann. Tom Cleary has been on this programme many times in the past, from Carrick O'Brien in Athlone, a well-known horse trainer. What are the conditions like there today, Tom? Good morning.
Good morning. The conditions, that nobody really in danger at the moment, but all the rain that's forecast and all the rain we've had, which takes a few days to make its way down to here, that is frightening, all right. We are definitely expecting a high flood going by the forecast, and as I said, all the rain that has to travel down yet. It started coming about a week ago, and after two nights' rain, we had a flood. Now, it's been rising rapidly ever since, but it's not on the roads. There's no houses threatened at the moment, but it's only a matter of time before that happens, unless they release up on 800 cubic metres per second down at Park Dean Weir. Now, I did request for that to be done earlier on, before this heavy rain came, but I don't think it was done. I'd say it's probably, once again, it's probably left too late.
Well, prevention is better than cure. That's, I suppose, the mantra you're trying to preach. Who did you contact Correct. About this?
I actually contacted a TD. I won't mention his name at the moment, and I'm not sure whether he done anything about it or not. But I did contact another TD this morning. I contacted Robert Troy. He's a man who's done a lot here for us in the past as regards getting water released at Park Dean Weir. So he tells me that he's getting straight on to the minister, Patrick O'Donovan, and they will act on it today.
How much damage has it done to you in the past, Tom?
Well, in the past, it's done a lot of damage. As you know, I'm a racehorse trainer, and I have gallops, I have walkers, and lunging arenas and paddocks. Now, they've all been badly damaged on two to three occasions, and it's taken a lot to bring them back. And when you be back at a stage where you say, okay, I'm back to where I was, the flood appears again. So that's what has happened in the past, and that would be my fear, that it would happen again.
We'll make inquiries. One of the challenges, of course, is there are so many agencies with different responsibilities for the Shannon. ESB, absolutely, for Party and Weir, but you've got Office of Public Works, you've the local councils, Waterways Ireland. It's very hard to know who's taking the lead on this. Tom, I hope the water stays at bay. Thank you very much for your time.
All right, thank you.
Tom Cleary from Carrick O'Brien in Athlone. Coming up on nearly 20 past 10 already.
Midlands Today with Tullamore Opel, Church Road, Tullamore. A new year? Get ready to go further with the new generation of Astra. Waiting for you at Tullamore Motors Opel. See tullamoremotors.ie.
On text and WhatsApp, Hilda. Well, you've been busy with many messages today. The Pope should, says a bunch of Protestant researchers in Cambridge, he points out. Yes, that was a little ironic. This is about bringing back the meat-free Friday. And she also wonders if Shane Ross would criticise the Repealy Rays for touring funerals. Well, many politicians and of all parties and persuasions will be seen at funerals, and indeed the opening of envelopes, some of them as well. Teresa in Clara says when she did an interview for a book once upon a time, a journalist said she had to sign legal documents giving permission for the quotes to be printed. You cannot just write a book about anybody. You have to follow protocol in all areas of writing that book. And she wonders, would Shane Ross let anybody write a book about him and say what they like? I don't think so, she says. Well, as you heard in the interview, he tried a number of channels to try and get cooperation for his book about Mary Lou MacDonald and was refused through official channels and wrote his book anyway. Will, the BBC is funded in the UK solely by the television licence and they are not allowed to generate extra money by showing adverts. Why is RTE getting the licence fee and showing ads? Well, and this is an open goal you're giving me here in the commercial sector. Obviously, stations like Midlands 103 would very much like to see RTE not compete for advertising. But the reality is, if you're paying €160 in your licence fee and they're generating €200 million from that, and they have another €140 million coming in through commercial revenue, you would be facing a very stiff increase in licence fee for RTE to stop showing ads. And I don't think too many people would be willing to pay that. So you kind of have to swallow the ads and put up with them. And that's what pays the bills, ultimately. Now, next on Midlands 103, who do you support in this situation? There was a couple who were furious with a Michelin star restaurant in Kinsale that took a €250 booking on their credit card despite them cancelling because their daughter was in an emergency department. You'll get the full story and then tell me who you think is right after these. In a few minutes, we remember Lindsay Bennett, the local cancer campaigner who was laid to rest in recent days. And one of the ways we remember her is to try and highlight with Dr. Deirdre Ford the signs of cervical cancer, the ways to get screened, and the options if you should receive bad news. Also, Athlone's great dilemma, what to call the newest bridge when there is already a new bridge. Now, who's right in this scenario? Paul and Helen MacDonald own Bastion, which is a Michelin star restaurant in Kinsale, and they received a pretty negative review on TripAdvisor from a diner who called to cancel their reservation less than an hour before they were due to eat in the restaurant. The restaurant only has 12 seats. So they explained they were in an emergency department with their daughter, awaiting tests to figure out how seriously injured she was. But despite the circumstances, their credit card was immediately charged €250, which is the full menu price for two people at the restaurant. And this is in line with the cancellation policy. Now, the restaurant responded to the negative review on TripAdvisor to explain that while they have a waiting list, they would not be able to find an alternative customer given just 1 hour's notice. And it got us thinking about the fairness of these policies, and even in those extenuating circumstances, if everybody rings you and if everybody has a sob story, how do you know who's telling the truth and who is not? Ray Byrne runs Wineport in Glasson, among many other restaurants in the hospitality sector. Good morning, Ray.
Morning, Will. Thanks for having me on.
Difficult one, this. What would you do in that situation?
Well, like, it isn't that difficult, really. But I would preface the discussion by saying, you know, that, yeah, and we might go into it some day we'd have more time. Just bear in mind, and the listeners might be interested to hear this, and they might be surprised to hear this, that typically in the restaurant business, the more you pay for your dinner as a customer, the less money the restaurant makes.
Right. That sounds odd.
Sounds odd, but, you know, again, there's a long history of it, and it's all to do with, you know, if you have the linen cutlery and the Newbridge crystal and all those things, or the Newbridge silverware and all those things on the table, and more waiters and more chefs, and the costs are higher, and the expectation is greater naturally for the customer because they're paying more money, and there's wine from seven continents in the cellar. It all costs more. You end up doing less covers, and as a result, the guy who's next door who has a restaurant that doesn't have, say, cutlery or crockery is actually making a lot more money.
Everybody should be running a chipper in that case.
Don't tell everyone.
Right. Okay, so bearing in mind this restaurant probably running on slim enough margins.
Yes.
If they lose a booking, it makes a big dent in their takings for the night, more so than perhaps a smaller restaurant.
Yeah, and I just think of that phrase from the restaurant point of view, you would have sympathy for them, but I suppose the issue is, you know, when you're explaining you're losing to a degree. So, you know, if it was a U2 concert and the couple were in the hospital and said, oh, we have our tickets for the concert, you know, if you rang up U2's management and said, listen, we're not sure we can make it because we're in the hospital, you know, you would get short shrift. So really the restaurant are slightly at fault because they need to explain that cancellation better, and they need to sell their seats as if they're selling a ticket for a performance. It's Michelin star. It's, you know, they're putting a lot of work into it. It's a husband and wife. They're sourcing the produce. They're there in the kitchen all day, and then the show starts at 8 o'clock, and the customers arrive in. So, you know, the restaurant should really say, listen, you can buy it, you know, a ticket or a seat. It'll cost you £250 for the two of you, and you pay up front, and thanks very much. And if you don't turn up, you don't turn up.
Maybe this is unfair, but it reminds me of Ryanair. So if you book to fly with Ryanair, you accept you're going to get no frills, maybe not the best customer service. That's part of the deal. But if you book with a more expensive airline, you expect a bit more sympathy, a bit more hand-holding, whatever you need.
Sure.
And maybe people feel the same towards restaurants, that if it's high-end, there should be that bit of grace that you wouldn't get in the bargain basement.
Sure, and like that is a fair point. And people do pay those exorbitant, you know, business price tickets, and they can be cancelled and rebooked at short notice. And, you know, maybe it's a leaf that the restaurant industry could take out of its book and say, well, listen, we're charging you know, £400 for that dinner. But if you cancel, it's not a problem.
Mm.
And, you know, and you can book again, or we'll make the thing valid. But certainly looking at it on TripAdvisor and looking at the various posts on social media, what I was amazed by was that the public support for the restaurant was definitely a lot higher than the support for that poor, unfortunate couple with their child in the hospital.
Well, how common is this no refund policy if you cancel? Because a few years ago it was unheard of, and I think we chatted to you at the time. These
Yep.
days, maybe people are more used to it.
Well, it's still rare enough, but you'll often see, you know, in busy, popular, successful restaurants that they will say, you know, they might say something like, we'll hold your table for 15 minutes, and they might say, if you don't come, there's a £50 or there's a £10 or there's a £20 charge per person, and you'll have given in that your credit card numbers when you're making the booking. So it's probably beginning to be a bit more commonplace. You know, it still wouldn't be as prevalent as, say, you know, you book a hotel for the weekend and they take your credit card number and you ring up and you say, listen, we can't go, our plans have changed. And they say, well, it's within the cancellation period and unfortunately we're going to have to charge you. So it's not quite as common as the hotel, but it's probably creeping in more, you know, in the restaurant sector. And it is as a result of, you know, I suppose a constant level, you know, probably less than 10%, but it's in the twos and threes and fours and growing percent of no-shows.
Let me just give you some reactions. So a caller says, Will, I'm a chef. This happens quite a bit. If the couple were to show proof they were in the hospital with their child, the decent thing to do would be to give the refund, not otherwise. Another person says, it depends on the restaurant. Some will get a lot of walk-in trade and the seats can be filled very easily and quickly. But this particular example in Cork was a far more specialised offering, so they weren't going to be able to replace the income.
Sure, and it does strike me that accidents seem to happen to restaurant goers disproportionately more than the general public.
Indeed. Ray, always good talking with you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Ray Byrne from Wineport in Glasgow.